Every Tuesday at 11 a.m., a sizable group fills the body movement room at Turning Point for a class called Tai Chi for the Heart.
Typically start off with a short meditation, then we go through some warm-ups, and then we go through Tai Chi movements.
Al Husser has diabetes. He's also supporting a wife with multiple sclerosis. He's been coming to this class every week for more than 5 years, and he loves it.
So, as always, with the feet flat on the floor, eyes closed easily and naturally, and the tip of the tongue lightly touching the gums there behind the top two front teeth. And then we let those breaths just fill us like a wave from the abdomen all the way up through the chest.
Tai Chi might sound like an unconventional way of dealing with serious medical conditions, but for some people it helps. It's not a cure, but it helps. When it comes to pain, especially chronic pain, opioids are the go-to treatment. But in light of an opioid epidemic, has anyone found viable alternatives for living with pain? I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's what we'll be discussing on KCUR's Central Standard. Call 816-235-2888 if you're a pain sufferer or a caretaker who's found something that makes it even a little bit easier to manage pain. Or if you found that medication is the only way, you can let us know about that too. 816-235-2888. Kathy Pendleton is with us from the Turning Point. That's the Holistic Healing Center where we just heard that Tai Chi class. And Cindy, how do you define pain?
Well, for everybody, I think that the experience of pain can be a little bit different. But pain is really a disruption. Pain causes a disruption in the quality of people's lives. There can be all kinds of pain. I know the focus today will be physical pain, but there can also be mental, emotional, and spiritual pain, as well as physical pain. And there can be a real interplay between all of those, because someone living with physical pain, especially chronic physical pain, oftentimes will be challenged in those other parts of their lives as well.
What do you see as the difference between the kind of pain most of us have experienced at some point, like we've fallen down or been in an accident or gotten ill? Like, what's the difference between that and chronic pain? Is it just the duration or something else?
For some, it can mean the duration. For some, it can mean the duration plus the intensity. If it's an acute kind of pain, typically we know that there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. With chronic pain, people who are living with that are living with a lot of uncertainty. They may wake up in the morning and not know if this is going to be a day when they're going to be in a lot of physical pain, or if this might be a good day where their pain feels very manageable. I think one of the challenges of living with pain is just that. It's that living with uncertainty, not knowing what their level of pain will be, not knowing what their level of energy will be, because living with chronic pain is very fatiguing. It takes a lot of energy.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would equate what you're saying. Like, if someone told me, you've got to run to the end of that block or something, no matter how much I hate running, I can probably do that. But if someone says, run, and I'm not going to tell you how long you have to go, you just have to keep going until I arbitrarily say stop, that would be a really different experience.
It would be a totally different experience. And it is one of the challenges for folks who are living with chronic pain, because one of the things I hear a lot from our participants at Turning Point is how challenging it can be on their social life, because friends might call and say, you want to get together Friday night? And if I'm the one living with chronic pain, I might say, I would love to. And if I'm feeling the way I'm feeling right now, I'm going to be able to do that. But when I wake up Friday morning, I might feel very differently about that, either because I'm having a high level of pain or because I'm feeling so tired, I simply don't have the energy, which is why I encourage people to get real picky about how they spend their available energy.
What are the kinds of things that you, like specific things that you recommend for people dealing with physical pain?
One of the things that we teach at Turning Point is to practice self-calming strategies. We know that there's a cycle that can so often happen for people with pain, where when they're in pain, there's understandably some anxiety that their pain may get worse or they might not be able to manage it that day. And just the tightening of the muscles can, in a way, add to that pain. And then it's just a cycle between the physical pain and the thoughts they tell themselves. And so one of the things that we do at Turning Point is to teach mind-body therapies, meditation. I do a weekly meditation group and have had people in there talk about how just the practice of self-calming strategies, whether that's meditation, whether it's practicing breathing throughout the day, but it can really help soften the edges of their pain.
This gets into sort of tricky territory, though, doesn't it? Because I feel like, I mean, one of the things that's hard about pain for a lot of people is that, especially if the source or cause of the pain hasn't been really clearly identified, people can often be told it's all in their head. So the idea of like a self-calming strategy is going to fix this, in a way, could play into that whole idea.
And we would never tell anybody that just do this and your pain will be gone. What we teach at Turning Point are complementary strategies. We really are supporters of encouraging people to use our strategies as a complement to what other strategies their healthcare team, because you're absolutely right with that, Gina. We don't ever want to give the impression that just do this and you won't have pain.
What do you think? I mean, we're going to be turning to someone with some broader expertise in just a moment, but what do you think would be an appropriate role for medication in treating pain? I know that you're more of an observer of that side of it, but you encounter a lot of people dealing with a whole big healthcare picture.
We really encourage open communication between the person living with pain and their healthcare team. I think it's important to know to keep that conversation going with their team and to keep their healthcare team apprised of which medications are working. Some people like to keep diaries, daily diaries of when their pain is worse, when it's less. So that open communication piece around the medication with the healthcare team is just critical.
Well, we're going to get back to some of these ideas in a little while, but now let's hear from Myra Christopher with us from the Center for Practical Bioethics, where she specializes in pain and palliative care. Good morning, Myra.
Good morning, Gina.
How does the prescription of opioids fit into the current protocol for treating pain medically?
I'd like to say before I answer that question that I absolutely agree with how Kathy described the experience of pain, but I think there's a really important distinction that you didn't make, Kathy, that I'd like to insert in this conversation.
Sure.
And I think it leads then to the response about the medication
okay, cool.
question. Acute pain is a symptom. So as you said, Gina, I've fallen down, I've been in a car accident, I've wrenched my knee, ice skating, whatever. Chronic pain is a neurologic disease. It is a condition that occurs as the result of acute pain not being appropriately managed. So if pain persists 3 to 6 months after the cause of the pain has dissipated, then actually the brain rewires itself and you develop a chronic disease.
So it's like your body is kind of sending a message that...
Exactly. And we all know the phenomenon about phantom limb pain, that we have veterans who come back who have lost limbs, but they still have the pain, and they are living with chronic pain. So it's a very important distinction. And I'm sure as we find our way into talking about opioids further, this will come up again. So I wanted to bring that
sure.
into the conversation. So
no, that
your
is
question
helpful.
About how do opioids fit into this, or prescription pain medications fit into this. We know that opioids only work for about half of the people to whom they are prescribed.
Half.
About half. We also know that for those who receive benefit from these medications, it only reduces their pain by about 30%. I was on the Institute of Medicine committee that published a State of Pain report in 2011 called Relieving Pain in America. And we tried very hard to advocate for a shift from a biomedical model, which really means prescription medications, interventional approaches, nerve blocks, steroid injections, things like that, and surgeries, to a biopsychosocial or comprehensive chronic pain management or integrated pain management model, which is what Kathy is talking about. Something that may include those biomedical approaches, or it may not. It may also include Tai Chi, acupuncture, therapeutic massage, diet, nutrition counseling. Behavioral health is a very important component of it. So the reason we have become so reliant upon the biomedical model, there are a number of factors. We've sort of created the perfect storm. Most people who receive treatment for acute pain are primary care providers. Our clinicians do not receive appropriate training around pain management. The average physician in the United States, according to the NIH, receives about 11 hours in his or her entire course of training to about remedying pain, although it's the number one reason people see a physician. I find it interesting that the average veterinarian receives about 87 hours and pain management.
Whoa, wait, why do you think there's this distinction? I mean, that is pretty interesting because we think of, I mean, maybe people do see pain management as more of a goal in a veterinary scenario, like you aren't necessarily going to try and keep your dog alive to 30 or 40.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of reasons for the distinction, but I think it primarily has to do with really a model of Western medicine that focuses on the scientific. If you can't touch it, weigh it, taste it, it doesn't exist. And as Kathy is saying, it's an experience. It is certainly a physical response, but it is also more than that. It is an experience. So,
well, let's bring assessing.
I want to just finish this one point, that the average physician, primary care doc, has 7 to 15 minutes to see that patient. So the quickest thing he or she can do to help their patient is to write a script, and their insurance company will pay for it. It won't pay for what Kathy's doing.
So that does bring up, though, when you're talking about the inability to measure it, to weigh it, when we're talking about pain, how do we assess pain? I mean, I know that hospitals and doctors will often use that sliding scale of differentiated smiley and frowny faces, or like that scale of 1 to 10. But honestly, as a patient, that has always felt totally insane to me. I can't even tell you where my desire for a sandwich right now is on a scale of 1 to 10.
Well, and actually, we are trying to do away with the pain scale. It doesn't work. And in fact, it's been used against patients. We know that for populations of patients who have been traditionally marginalized, if you say your pain is a 10, the nurse will write it down as an 8.
Whoa, wait, why is that?
It is because we stereotype people. We know that racism and sexism exist in our healthcare delivery system. And those populations that are perceived as perhaps drug-seeking or not quite up to our standards, then their response, their self-report is minimized. So how do we measure it? So, I mean, there are a number of ways. There's no litmus test for this. So it's not like you can, you know, give them a urine specimen and they can come back and say, yes, this person has chronic pain, and no, that person doesn't. There has been some effort to say, well, MRIs will show that the brain lights up. But that's not even really readily reliable. You can put two people side by side, smash one person's hand, and their MRI will light up, smash the other person's hand, and it may or may not. So the only way to really do it is through, to determine pain, is through self-report. But in lieu of doing a 1 to 10 scale, The shift is really towards functionality. So tell me about your physical experience, and let's talk about how that impacts your life. Kathy has mentioned many ways. I just had a shoulder replacement a few weeks ago. So when I thought about this yesterday morning, at that point, when I went into my parking lot at work, I could not put my pass in front of the keypad. I had to park my car, open my door, turn, and use my other arm that already had a titanium shoulder. Yesterday, I could just whip my arm out and put my pass there. So it's about functionality. What are the limitations that you experience? Maybe physical, but it may also be social. As Kathy said, it may also be psychological.
What is the goal when it comes to treating chronic pain? Are you trying to make it go away altogether, or is it something else?
You know, years ago, we would say, you know, people ought to be able to get their pain down to zero. Our goal was
that's
to eradicate pain.
That's back to that sliding scale, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's just ridiculous, because when people, if you have acute pain, that is a realistic goal. But if you have chronic pain, that is not a realistic goal. So I think what you have to do is say to the patient or the person, what is it that's important to you? And you have to set goals of care, goals of treatment that are consistent with their goals and their life values. I may be willing to live with quite a bit of pain to do certain things that I enjoy.
When KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll be hearing real people's personal stories about managing pain, or trying to anyway. Call 816-235-2888 if you've got something to say. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, talking about treating and managing pain, especially chronic pain, with Myra Christopher at the Center for Practical Bioethics and Kathy Pendleton, who offers alternative and complementary therapies at The Turning Point. Now let's talk with people who have suffered from chronic pain about what it's like. We're going to start with Jill Sullivan, who's with us in the studio, and then we're going to get to your calls. Jill, good morning.
Good morning.
What was your life like before your journey with pain began? Paint the picture for me.
My life before pain was an active mother, a soccer coach, a really busy person, and happy, joyful.
What happened, and how did that change?
On November 6th, in 1996, I bought into what many people at the time were doing, and I went to my primary care and asked for Fenvin. And within three doses, I had a neurological event that has caused permanent double vision.
What was your first perception? I mean, when did you first identify that you had had what you describe as a neurological event?
I was just incredibly dizzy and did not know what was going on. It was a very, very odd day.
It sounds, just dizziness was the main thing.
And what I didn't realize it, the dizziness was because I couldn't see, and that everything was doubled, but I hadn't really realized that that's why I was dizzy.
So what did you do? How did you progress from this sensation of dizziness to understanding that you had moved into some kind of new territory in your life?
I went to the urgent care that night, and over the course of the next few days, realized that I wasn't dizzy. I just couldn't see, and that everything was doubled. And the thing with when you have double vision is that your eyes and your brain are fighting to, you have single and then it's double and single and then it's doubled, which
so you're
causes,
trying to fix it and like correct
yes.
what you see. Yeah.
And, in this process, it causes intense headaches. And I was convinced I was going blind, and that even though I could still see at the same level, I just couldn't make it out to be one. It's a real mind game when you are 40 years old and suddenly you can't see.
Yeah. I'm assuming you went back to the doctor fairly quickly.
I was seen by every strabismus, and that's what double vision is called, specialist in Kansas City, and was not really given much help.
And what were you given? How did people respond to what you were sharing?
I had a number of doctors that kind of thought it was in my head. I went to one doctor that thought it was my thyroid and another doctor that thought I was making it up. And ultimately, my regular eye doctor sent me to Dr. Scott at the University of Iowa. And he was very helpful. He focused on doing a number of different glasses, trying to correct it. Initially told me, don't ever have surgery. And ultimately, about 2 years later, that's all he had to offer.
Just don't have surgery. But where does the pain sort of factor into your symptoms? Or I guess we've said that chronic pain isn't really a symptom. It's its own thing. But
right.
Describe the pain.
With the double vision and your brain fighting to make a single, and with chronic daily migraines, it is in all different places. It might be over one eye. In an hour, it might be the backside of my head. It is nonsensical. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And I can understand why people think that maybe possibly you're crazy when you say, well, what do you mean you've got a migraine that's, you know, your eyebrow and then it's the backside of your head alternating. And it just doesn't, it isn't to be understood, because you can't fix the brain. The brain is the brain. And so it is very complicated.
Myra Christopher, I just want to get your input real quick. I want to get back to Jill's story, but this idea about it being all in someone's head.
You know, I laugh when I hear that. Kathy mentioned it in her comments that people are told, oh, it must be in your head. When we were doing the work at the Institute of Medicine on this issue, Dr. John Ferrer from the University of Pennsylvania commented, well, of course it's all in your head because it's a neurologic disease. Where the hell would it be? So it is the case that it's the brain that is sending the pain response. In Jill's case, her pain is also located in her head. But for people who have sickle cell, for example, it may be in their joints. For people who have advanced osteoarthritis, it may be in their neck. It may be in their sacral. It may be in their knees. So chronic pain, the disease itself is a neurologic disease.
Quite literally in your head.
It is in your brain, literally.
But not in the sense.
It may manifest itself in different parts of the body and in different ways, as Jill is saying.
Well, so Jill, what's changed since your original diagnosis? How long ago?
In 1996.
So, yeah, a little more than 20 years.
So a lot of things have changed. My ability to cope has changed enormously. I was able to get some complementary care. I went to a program many, many, many years ago that taught me relaxation and a number of other tools to get through the day. And then more recently, I found a cognitive behavioral therapist who taught me a lot of tools on how to kind of find a way to have moments of joy amongst the pain. And I can be at an 8 and I can go to a cat show and enjoy myself. I can be at an 8 and I can decide that I'm right on the edge of needing to just stop. I can lay down on the couch and take a break. And then when it's subsided slightly, I get up and do my thing.
I've heard the experience of pain management described as not eliminating pain, but like putting earmuffs on it.
That's a good terminology. Or and possibly maybe more filters over it, because like if you focus on nothing but the pain, then you have a miserable life.
Well, let's talk to some of our other callers who have some experience with this and see what they have to share. Let's hear from Randy in Lake Lackawanna. Good morning, Randy.
Good morning. How are you today?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
Well, I'm always in pain. I have been a pain clinic patient for 20 years and have taken narcotics for pain for about that long. And my pain is largely under control. But you were talking about pain scales. I would say my pain scale never goes below 4, to give you an idea, and I'm okay with that.
Describe calling, outside of a number, just real quick for me, what the 4 feels like that you never get below.
I'll give you an example. I have idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, a terminal lung disease. And I don't get enough oxygen in my system, even when I'm using oxygen. And so my muscles will deplete of oxygen and become painful. And that's a background level of pain that I experience all the time. And you kind of learn to live with it. You take your medication, which keeps it from being a 7 or an 8, and you live your life.
How do you? But, okay, go on.
What I called about is, can I go on with something else?
Yeah.
Because it's I had mentioned I have idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, and the only cure for that is a bilateral lung transplant. And so I've worked with my pulmonologist at KU to find someone who would do that. We didn't do that in the Kansas City area. And Baylor University in Houston, and Houston Methodist. And they both refused to speak with me because I take pain medication.
You know, Randy, I've got to jump in because our line is a little wonky, and I just want to make sure I heard you correctly. Did you say that the doctor refused to see you because you're
yes.
taking narcotic pain medication?
In essence, because I take morphine for pain, my life isn't worth saving. And they're pretty blunt about it.
Well,
that they just won't see me. That they have other patients, and that I'm sure that all of the publicity that the people who abuse pain medication gets rubbed off on people who don't abuse it.
Let me get some feedback from this on this from our bioethicist here.
Surely.
Myra, first of all, the idea, there are a couple ideas I want to talk about here. One being the idea that some people somehow their pain does not merit treatment, particularly if they're currently using the kinds of medications Randy's talking about.
The quote-unquote opioid epidemic has contributed greatly to further stigmatization and stereotyping of chronic pain patients, although there are no data to indicate that chronic pain patients are any more likely to abuse or misuse opioids than anyone else in the general population. In fact, we believe it is probably less so because chronic pain patients need their medications. Randy needs his medications to have some quality of life. But the reality is that in March of 2016, the Centers for Disease Control, where this clarion call around the opioid epidemic was issued, published a set of guidelines that they call opioid, the title is Opioid Prescribing for Chronic Pain. And it has had just terrible unintended consequences from my perspective. It is an effort to try to contain the prescribing of opioids. And let me be really clear here. I'm really agnostic about opioids. I think that if they work for people, they should have access to them. I think it should be one little piece of a comprehensive approach. If they don't work, like any other medication, they shouldn't be prescribed. However, in this guideline, they set limits. And Randy, I don't want you to tell me how much medication you're taking. I'm not a clinician. It would mean nothing to me. But they set limits on dosage and duration of prescribing. The CDC has tried to avoid criticism by saying, well, these are voluntary. But what we see happening all over the country now is that clinics and clinicians and legislators and other policymakers, members of state medical boards and others, are codifying these. And Randy, they are having terrible, again, I want to emphasize, unintended consequences. Should the CDC ever come to the realization that what they're really talking about is guidelines for acute pain management, I'd be all over it. I'd be their biggest cheerleader. We do grossly mismanage acute pain.
So, and like someone's got a broken arm.
Or they've had their wisdom teeth extracted or, you know, any of those things. We have a real problem, and it is a growing problem, of people who are struggling to live with a chronic disease, who are being denied access to treatment that in many instances is sort of a life-saving therapy for them.
What confuses me about this is that, you know, if someone is potentially in, like, for the sake of argument, truly in danger of being susceptible to addiction to opioids, wouldn't that also be a reason to see that person and help them?
Yes. Yes. And Gina, your point, I think this is where you're going. Substance use disorder and or addiction is also a disease. It's not a moral failure. So we want people to have access to treatment no matter what their diagnosis is. But the confusion between these two public health issues, chronic disease care, the under-treatment of chronic pain, and substance use disorders, particularly opioid addiction, is causing terrible consequences for actually, I believe, both populations. And we don't understand it. And frankly, NIH is not investing very much to try to understand, research these issues and better understand their relation or correlation.
Well, Randy, thank you so much for your call. We're going to hear now from a physician who's on the line, William in Lawrence. Hi, good morning.
Hi. My name is William Hale. I see a certain number of patients with pain, and I teach 8-week courses in mindfulness-based stress reduction to a variety of people, including people with pain. One thing I wanted to mention is the difference between suffering and pain, because that's really significant to this discussion.
Explain that.
Pain is a physical sensation, and we tend commonly to pretty much equate suffering and pain, but in fact, though they are, there's a lot of overlap, suffering is a little bit different. Suffering is the combination of our pain and all the reactivity that we generate, mostly unconsciously, outside of awareness, to pain. We generate reactivity in the body with bracing and tensing and increases of heart rate and blood pressure and so on. we create reactivity emotionally with fear or depression or anger about pain or other emotions.
Yeah, you know, William, what you're talking about sounds in some ways like an echo of some of the things we heard from Kathy earlier on. And Kathy, having listened to stories like Randy's and like Jill's and hearing this physician speak and hearing our other guest, Myra, talking to us about the importance in some cases of people being able to get access to medication, what have you been thinking? I mean, from your experience working with people and finding ways to make life with pain manageable?
Well, just to piggyback on your current caller and on what Jill was saying earlier, in addition to the self-calming strategies that have been talked about, Jill mentioned part of your pain management program is some distraction in things that mean a lot to you. Like you said, when you go to that cat show, it's joy. You know, you can get away from it. And that's another really powerful strategy when it comes to complementary pain management. It's distraction, but it's not just distraction on anything. In the resilience world, it's called self-replenishment. It's moving towards focusing on things that you can get lost in, whether that's playing the piano for hours because that's your joy, or going to a cat show.
But
can
I jump in here? Because
sure.
I have always thought that part of the measure of the intensity of pain is whether you are able to enjoy things that typically bring you joy. And if the answer is no, how can you lose yourself in these things? I mean, if your hands hurt, how can you lose yourself in playing the piano?
Well, then playing the piano may not be the self-replenishing distraction for you. But an example is somebody who's living with pain and this is an example that we've heard at Turning Point, living with pain, but when he goes to his kid's basketball game, that's his focus, and it's his joy seeing his grandson play. And so it's finding those things that give such meaning to your life and incorporating them into your schedule.
When KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll get right back to this conversation about living with chronic pain. We're going to hear from more of our callers and get those into the conversation. You can still add something at 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Myra Christopher from the Center for Practical Bioethics and with Kathy Pendleton from the Turning Point. We've also got Jill Sullivan, someone who is living with pain right now in the studio, sharing her story. And so are our callers at 816-235-2888. Jill, you know, you've been listening to some other people's stories. Is there something that you want to add, having heard more from other people, that you think we should be really paying attention to here?
I think the most important thing to say to those pain sufferers out there, pain livers out there, is to not give up and to find joy in, even if it's 5 seconds at a time. Get up in the morning and look out the window. There's a bird. There's the sun is shining. Find something and live in that moment and capitalize on it. There is joy even if you're in pain.
Let's hear from Jessica in Kansas City, who has something to add to this conversation. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
What do you want to share?
So, well, to what Jill was just saying about finding some hope and joy, the way that I do that is I have chronic pain. I've had chronic pain for 8 years. I attend Turning Point, and I've also been to some of the bioethics groups. And what I've also done to add on to that to help give me some hope is I've volunteered with the local Kansas City chapter of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. And I've also been volunteering with New Approach Missouri, which is the medical cannabis initiative statewide for Missouri that we're trying to put on the ballot for 2018. And I think when you're having a conversation about chronic pain, it's essential to include medical cannabis as a very viable option that we're seeing across the nation.
Jessica.
Are getting off opioids.
Yeah, let me ask you a question. I mean, can you, I know that it sounds like you have a really strong argument to make, probably politically, about this. And I'd love to hear, just from a personal standpoint, just in your own story, what the role of cannabis has been in managing your pain.
I don't believe it's political at all. I believe it's a human rights and social justice issue, just to treat people who are sick with better options. You heard from Myra about how opioids are very ineffective at treating people, and you heard about people who get addicted, but they, you know, doctors are cutting off their patients, but really that's the only treatment people in Missouri and Kansas have. They don't have other options, and it's unethical. It's wrong to not allow them to have a conversation with their doctor about cannabis as a viable treatment. And it matters to me because I'm a young person and I've been on opiates now for 8 years. I can't continue the rest of my life like that. You know, I do meditation, I do biofeedback, I do cognitive behavioral therapy, I do everything else that I can, but it's not enough. And long-term opiates is not an option for me to live a quality life. And I think the quality of life part is also really essential to this conversation.
Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, if you don't mind my, I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. Are you saying that you would like an option that you feel like right now does not exist for you to beyond long-term opioid use?
Yes, and it would be inappropriate for me to go on my own to try something like that and risk losing my freedom, even though I'm a chronic pain patient and I have a condition that would qualify me in any other legally medical state across the nation. But in Kansas and Missouri, that's not an option for me. And I can't even talk to my doctors about the science available.
Let's get
the data coming out of Colorado.
Let's get some feedback from our bioethicist.
Good morning, Jessica. You know, the issues around the use of cannabis are really clouded because we lack evidence base about its effectiveness. We have a lot of anecdotal information, evidence, that people who've really struggled to live with particular problems say, yes, it does help me. Even topical cannabis, some people with extreme joint problems say that it helps. In November of 2014, the NIH convened a group of scientists to research what we know about chronic pain and various remedies. There were four questions we focused on. And there was a report written called Pathways to Prevention, the Use of Opioids in Treating Chronic Pain. And an independent group of scientists came back and said, basically, we don't know anything about the remedies that we currently use, or we know very little. Evidence was low to moderate at the very best. So I'm always a little bit stymied about why we will use one therapy when we have no evidence for it, but we will refuse to use another. And I believe it is very politicized. I think many of the problems around chronic pain and appropriate treatment have been politicized. And
How do we break out of that?
Well, I think the way you break out of it is for professionals to take control of this issue and say that, you know, state legislators making decisions about the dosage of medications they can prescribe is just not acceptable. The biggest criticism about the CDC guidelines that I mentioned earlier, there were 12 recommendations. All were categorized by CDC as strong recommendations. By statute, they have to say what their evidence base was. Evidence base for all 12 recommendations was low. At the highest, it was moderate. So we have got to begin investing in this issue. I haven't mentioned this, but we know that 100 million Americans, yes, 100 million Americans live with chronic pain. Now, there's a broad spectrum there. About a third of those live with what we have labeled in the National Pain Strategy Report high-impact chronic pain. It is disabling to them. They cannot live a normal life.
Let's get to another story, and I really want to thank Jessica for sharing her perspective, because, yeah, that's...
It's brave.
Yeah. Rusty, welcome to KCUR Central Standard. Hello, Rusty.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Hi. I'm sorry, it's been a while. First of all, I agree with every single solitary thing that's been said on this show. It needs to be said. I'm a physician, and I ran a chronic pain clinic successfully for several years. I was audited by the DEA at one point, and reviewing 22,000 prescriptions, I did not find a single error or misuse of the medication. I was then involved in an accident which required 23 surgeries to replace numerous joints. I still got two more surgeries to go. And let me tell you, the status of pain treatment in this city is abysmal. Doctors are not interested in treating pain. They don't want to take more than 5 to 7 minutes. A good pain treating process takes at least 20 to 30 minutes on each follow-up. You have to follow patients up closely. Patients are being driven to using marijuana off the street as well as heroin. We are litigating or changing laws to protect 3,500 people who died of overdose last year and depriving 30 million people of chronic pain treatment, a third of which over lifetime will kill themselves. I mean, the way they're dealing with this is absolutely ridiculous. I find physicians to be lazy, pressure for time, money-driven. I'm appalled by my own profession. And once I get back into practice, I'm going to reopen the pain clinic again because these doctors in this area do not care about it. William out of Lawrence is the only other voice I've heard on this issue in the last 3 years that I've gone through all my surgeries. So, and I do all the other things as well, yoga, Tai Chi, I work on the exercise bikes, and that does help a great deal because tension definitely adds to your pain. The last thing I want to say is the longer people are in pain that is treatable from surgical conditions like myself or the lung condition the other gentlemen have, the more disabled we become and the harder it is to get off a disability and back to being productive citizens. This process is so self-defeating. I could do a whole hour just by myself.
Rusty.
I'm telling you what's wrong. So I'm done.
No, I'm so sorry for what you've been going through. Good luck on those two surgeries that remain. And let's get some response to what you've said. There are a couple of specific things, Myra, that I'd like you to address. One is this discrepancy between the number of people who die of drug overdoses as compared to the number of people who suffer from chronic pain. If such a higher number suffer from chronic pain, I understand Rusty's argument that legislation and the approach of doctors shouldn't focus so much on that smaller number of people who end up becoming addicted to pain medications. However, can you just ignore that piece
no.
of it?
No.
And, this is and a real
actually, I think
ethical
Rusty,
problem.
Rusty just misspoke. Actually, the CDC has estimated the number of, and I want to be careful with this language, opioid-related deaths is approximated 30,000 last year, not 3,500. I have a number of problems with that. The one is the issue that you raise. It is about pitting these problems against one another, and sometimes I feel like I'm living through Vietnam again when we're comparing our body count to your body count, and that's not good public policy or public health policy. One of the real issues is that opioid-related deaths, someone can have opioids in their system, they can have a ton of benzos, so anti-anxiety medications, tranquilizers, and so forth, and a gallon of Jack Daniels that they've washed it down with. If they die, if there's a trace of opioid, it is counted as an opioid death. We had last year, in the same year it's estimated we had approximately 30,000 deaths associated with opioids. We had 80,000 deaths associated with alcohol. But America runs on martinis. So politically, we're not going to touch that one. So really, Rusty's comments bring me back to what I mentioned earlier, the war of the politicalization of this, which I think is deeply rooted in the so-called war on drugs, which has really become a war on patients.
Oh, man. And that could initiate a whole nother hour of conversation, and maybe it will. But that's all the time we have for this morning. Myra Christopher, thank you so much for those insights. and Kathy Pendleton, thank you as well.
My pleasure.
Jill Sullivan, it was brave to tell your story today, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
You can listen back to our conversation or share a link to it with someone you know at kcur.org/Central Standard later today. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about protest music as the Folk Alliance gets into gear. Tune in for that at 10 tomorrow morning. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from our intern, Caitlin Troutman. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.